Hi, I am Brittany Sonicson. I'm an oral surgeon in Los Angeles. I'm here today to interview Dr. Peter Larson for an OsteoScience Foundation podcast. And I'm really looking forward to this because Dr. Larson is not only a very accomplished oral surgeon, but he's a very important mentor of mine. He was the chair at Ohio State University when I was a resident there. And that's how we started and became friends, colleagues, and of course, he's a very important mentor. So Dr. Larson was at Ohio State for almost 36 years. He just recently retired, congratulations. And so what we're gonna do today is he'll sort of introduce himself, tell us a little bit about his oral surgery journey, his career accomplishments, which we can't get into all of them or we'd be here all day. And then just kind of talk about the importance of mentorship and having those type of relationships. Thanks, Dr. Larson.
Sounds good. Thanks, Brittany. So I'm really looking forward to this. I've trained, you know, probably 100 residents or more over the years, including some dental anesthesiology residents, oral surgeons. I've trained kids of residents that I trained. So that, you know, dates me. And, you know, I think that mentorship has been a really important part of my career path. I don't really want to talk about all my accomplishments from the standpoint of, you know, I was this or I was that, because I think that they aren't very interesting to people, for one thing. You can find that by, you know, looking me up, you know, on Google. You know, you might find some things about me that I don't want you to know too, you know. Social media has not always been, you know, something that I'm a big fan of. But I think that my path to oral surgery something that, you know, I was hoping we would talk about a little bit, and to, you know, and mentors that I've had over the years. You know, I think many of the mentors that I had, both obvious ones that were, you know, teachers of mine, you know, played a big role, and I'll get into that certainly, you know, but I think that would be more important and interesting, if, you know, if that's okay with you, Brittany.
That's it. Perfect. Yeah. So essentially, you know, originally what made you decide to become an oral surgeon and sort of what led you to that path? Where did you train, first of all?
Well, I trained at University of Oklahoma, Oklahoma Health Science Center. And I had, you know, I had kind of an unusual background, I think. My father was a physician. He was a hematologist. He actually was a surgeon. He was wounded in Korea and was unable to continue in a surgical career because of the injuries. And so he became a hematologist because he said, you know, I can sit around and count blood cells in a microscope. You know, I don't have to stand for hours and hours in the operating room. And so I grew up with a physician father in a time when most patients died from hematologic malignancies, you know, lymphoma, leukemia, multiple myeloma. Those were the things my father treated. And he was an academic. He was the chair at University of Kansas. And so I knew about residents, and we had fellows coming to our house and calling, you know, and professors coming and staying at our home, you know, sort of that thing. But I wasn't particularly interested in the aspect of medicine that I saw, which was, you know, mostly death, frankly. My father was a very gracious man, and you know, his hero was Albert Schweitzer, who was a very well-known missionary physician, and his whole thing was reverence for life, you know. And that was my father's mission, was helping people who had, you know, untreatable, uncurable disease, die with dignity. And that takes a very special kind of person. It was, you know, very difficult for me as a kid to sort of, I had great respect for him, but I wasn't sure I could do that. You know, sometimes mentors teach us what we can't do as well.
Right.
You know, and that was something I didn't think I could do. So, but he was a well-known academic guy, and he went to Dominican Republic as a visiting professor, part of a Christian Medical Dental Society sort of thing. And, you know, I tagged along. I think I was 15. And I was bored out of my mind. I mean, you know, he was lecturing and I was at Santo Domingo. And so they assigned me to this dentist. And the dentist was absolutely hilarious, greatest guy. And we went out into the, you know, into the boonies with, you know, a tool chest and a flashlight. Mm-hmm. And he just took teeth out all day long. And I held a flashlight and cleaned up, you know, and I didn't speak any Spanish, but, you know, we were close to Haiti. So some people would come in, I spoke French a little bit, and people would come in, I'd try and interpret. And, you know, I probably shouldn't admit it, but I actually probably took out a couple teeth somewhere along the line. And I came home and I wanted to be a dentist. I mean, I knew I wanted to be a dentist. And, you know, I chose Kansas State University to go to school. They had a great pre-dentistry program. They still have a great pre-professional program in Kansas at the time. There was there were no dental schools there still aren't. The state would help support you if you went to University of Missouri Kansas City, or if you went to Creighton University, a private dental school, either one, because they needed dentists to come and stay in Kansas. And so I ended up at Creighton and went to dental school there, and had, you know, really great mentors there. I had, you know, there's no specialty programs there. So I had very broad exposure to, you know, surgery and perio and endo, all different kinds of specialties. And, and that was really what led to me becoming a dentist. And then, of course, applying and going to the University of Oklahoma.
Nice. When you were in dental school, did you always know, were you always led to oral surgery, or did you dabble with other things?
It's interesting because I loved everything about medicine except the death and dying. Mm-hmm. And probably if someone would have taken me aside and said, you know, there are other aspects of medicine that you aren't seeing, you know, everybody I knew was an oncologist. So once I was in school, after a little while, I mean, I loved pharmacology. I liked medicine, physiology. I sort of knew that I was going to want to be a surgeon, but I loved dentistry. I really like to work with my hands. I know that's like a cliche thing when you're interviewing, you know, you're supposed to say, I like to work with my hands. But I really did. I was artistic in a lot of ways. And so I liked the challenge of dentistry. So it wasn't, I think some people become oral surgeons because they don't like dentistry.
Right.
And I think they struggle because so much of oral surgery is dealing with dentists, understanding the dental aspect, especially with implant treatment. You know, you really, if you hate dentistry, you're going to take more impressions as an oral surgeon than you might ever as a dentist. I think, you know, people don't really realize that it's not a way to avoid dentistry. It's just a way to do something a little bit more medically oriented. So, I think the advice I give to everybody that's in dental school is if you think you might want to go into oral surgery, you should work as absolutely hard as you can to make the grades, because that's the one thing you can't go back in time and redo. You know, you can work hard if you don't do well on boards or CBSE now, or, you know, you need to do some research or you need to do something. But if you make poor grades your first year or two, you know, it's over. And so I think, you know, I worked really hard because I knew that's what I might want to do.
Exactly. So let's get into a little bit about your career. I know you became young faculty and kind of went into academics and spent your whole career in academics. So can you kind of weigh on that and how that choice came, and then maybe talk about some of your faculty mentors when you were a young faculty?
Sure. University of Oklahoma was, like a lot of programs were back in the day, and that is residents had a significant amount of autonomy. And it was actually kind of unusual for trauma and infection patients, for instance, for an attending to ever participate in the operating room. We did those cases, you know, the chief resident was our mentor, and you learned a lot of basic surgery from your fellow residents. And, you know, I think it taught me early on to think a little bit for myself, and I had to have a little bit of leadership when I moved up through the ranks. But, you know, I had two really great mentors there. I don't want to make it sound like I didn't. Bob Markowitz was the chair, and he was a very young chair. He was only like 35 years old, you know, when he became chair, which was probably the youngest chair in the country at the time. And Dr. Markowitz was one of those people, and when I say this, Brittany, because you've been in the operating room with me, you'll understand, he was one of those people that was all about, you know, plan for the worst, hope for the best. If you have plan A, B, C, and D, and you go to the operating room, you should control your environment, every aspect of it. And as a resident, that can be threatening, because your anxiety is what have I forgotten? What's Dr. Markowitz going to be wanting? But after you do that for a little while, you realize that when you're in the operating room with someone who takes control of the operation that way, there's always somebody there that's going to help you. There's always a fallback. There's never flying by the seat of your pants. Whenever something terrible would happen, I knew Dr. Markowitz could fix it, you know? And I mean, that's a really great thing that I learned from him, that I think, you know, that sort of methodical approach, preparation. Jim Swift was he was in residency with me, Dr. Swift, who was chair in Minnesota for many years. You know, we're very close friends, and he's been one of my really strong mentors, but we were residents together. He's just a couple years ahead of me, and he stayed on the faculty at Oklahoma. And Jim taught me to love surgery, you know, because we had fun doing surgery with him, because he was the young guy, you know, the non-threatening person, but he's a very academically minded guy who's had a lot of inquisitiveness and was a little bit less rigid than Dr. Markowitz. And so while we had this sort of structure in the operating room, you know, when I went there with Dr. Swift, I could really enjoy it and learn. And I could also not be afraid to say, why are we doing it this way? You know, you wouldn't necessarily ask Dr. Markowitz why we were doing it a certain way, because he would probably say, because it's the only way. My way is right. And I've been guilty of that a little bit too. But Jim, on the other hand, you know, was a young guy. So those two guys together, you know, were a great mix. You know, they worked well for my time there to create in me sort of a sense that academics was good. And they were at a meeting, and you know, I was debating about, am I going to go to medical school? You know, am I going to go into private practice? You know, not sure what I wanted to do. And they met up with Larry Peterson. And, you know, everybody who knows Dr. Peterson called him Pete. His friends would call him Pete, but you would know him as Larry Peterson. He was the chair for many years at Ohio State University. And they had talked to Dr. Peterson, and he was looking for a new, young, vigorous faculty with a lot of experience. And one thing we did at Oklahoma was we did a ton of surgery, you know, hundreds of orthognathic cases, you know. And Dr. Peterson wanted somebody who could come there and just walk in there and teach surgery day one. And you know, I couldn't spell research, you know, when I was, I mean, I didn't have a master's, and I didn't, you know, I could read an article and know whether it was good research, probably, but I, you know, I couldn't write a paper. I didn't know anything. And he wasn't looking for that. He took somebody who had, you know, a lot of surgical experience and hired me and said, you know, there's this thing called tenure. And if you don't make it after 6 years, you know, you won't have a job. Don't worry about that. It just requires that you write, you know, a dozen papers and, you know, have some grants. And I'm like, you know, and I remember getting my first paper back from him that I had written. It weighed twice as much as it did when I gave it to him because the red ink on it was so heavy. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I couldn't read the thing because he had made so many red marks on there. And, you know, but he had faith in me. And I delivered. I think I was a good surgeon. I brought, you know, a level of surgical treatment, you know, formal orthognathic surgery training and things that, you know, that we didn't have. And, you know, and the two other faculty that were there were Barry Steinberg, who you would probably recognize that name. Barry's been, you know, at Jacksonville for many, many years, and Steve Feinberg. And Steve has been at University of Michigan for many years. And they both have PhDs. They were very, very academically minded. They've done a lot of research. And I'm, you know, I'm smart enough to learn from everybody around me. And those guys were good friends and still are really good friends of mine because, you know, I was just this dumb kid from Kansas. And I'm like, you know, so if I need to submit a grant, how do I do that? And you know, they would help me. And so, you know, probably the faculty that were there at Ohio State, you know, really, I think, helped me get to, you know, develop my career. But they also were friends. And I think that's the thing that my take home from all of this is that I'm still close friends with the people I was in residency with and my mentors there and, you know, and with Steve and Barry. And, you know, that's I think, probably the thing that's been the most rewarding. And that's sort of how I got to Ohio State and how I ended up, you know, how I made it. I would have never made it without those three people for sure.
Definitely. So obviously you stayed in academics and you learned how to write a paper. And as you, you know, became more senior faculty, you've not only mentored other younger faculty, but dozens and well, hundreds of residents. So, you know, I know that's always been an important part of your career. And I think that it's something that just comes natural to you, but, you know, just always kind of taking the time to do that. And not only in the operating room, but outside the operating room, in the office, kind of having an open door. You know, what advice would you have for sort of either new faculty or younger residents or students coming in as far as just, you know, how to form these relationships and how to find a good mentor?
Sure. That's your mentors, some of them they're going to be natural, you know, your chair or your program director or senior faculty. But I think, sometimes your mentors are people who may initially be a little bit off-putting because they ask you difficult questions or they make you uncomfortable, and sometimes they criticize. Okay, and I think advice number one would be you need to look past some of those things that make you uncomfortable.
Definitely.
Two is, I think, mentors are hiding a lot of places that you might not expect. Okay. Case in point, you know, Mike Maloro and I, we were there on faculty together and we fought like dogs. Okay. Because we're too much alike. And he would say, I don't remember us ever fighting, but you know, not in a bad way, but just in a, like, why are you doing that? I don't know. Why are you doing this? But Michael, although he's junior to me, and he was never formally, you know, one of my faculty, you know, we were co-faculty. He taught me a lot. Okay. He taught me things. And I was willing to learn it, even though, you know, there were times when we, you know, I could easily look past any of the negatives to the positives that were there. But a lot of people, you know, don't do that. And so I think, you know, look at some of your, at your co-faculty or even people that are junior to you, because they can provide mentorship to you, even though you're the, you know, the senior person. And then, you know, following through the third, the last thing is, you know, my residents. I think I learned a lot from residents about how to be a good teacher and how to do surgery, frankly. I didn't learn a lot from them early on in my career when I probably should have, because there's a little bit of, I don't know if it's pride or it's ego or there's anxiety, insecurity, whatever those things are. I'm attending, you know, but the resident, quite honestly, became more like my kids because I got older and they didn't. I realized that just like I learned a lot from my kids, if I listened to them, I could learn a lot from my residents. And so I think the third area, you know, of advice would be pay attention to the residents. Don't assume that just because they have less experience that they don't have a significant amount to offer you. How to take care of patients or, you know, even surgery. You know, they ask what they think are dumb questions, and you're like, I don't know
about that. Yeah,
but maybe we should think about that. Yeah. So
that's true. Would you have, you know, now that you're recently retired, would you have changed anything about your oral surgery journey, or did it kind of play out in the way that you expected?
I think the big thing for people when they retire, and maybe this will be valuable to you know, to people who are, you know, in my head, I'm still, you know, just as good at all those things that I used to do. And some people might say, well, why aren't you doing them still then? And, I think, there's a struggle when you, retire to feel relevant, right, still maintain relevance. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you've done all the relevant things, you know, you could be president of the board, chair for, you know, decades, you know, train all kinds of people, have all these, it's still, how am I relevant today? And academics does a really poor job, I think, they do a great job allowing the retired person who's been in practice to go in and dabble in, you know, oral surgery teaching, teach a couple days of the week, or go, you know, cover the residents in the clinic a day or something. But academics is really not set up to slow down. You know, I was mentoring residents, doing my research, taking call in a level one trauma center up until the last day that I was a faculty. And the expectation was that I would do that, because if I didn't, it's not like someone else was just going to be, it would have been the other faculty that had to take those things on. It's not like we could just say, you know, Dr. Larson's going to slow down, so we're going to slow down. And if I had decided to just slow down, you know, treating patients, well, you know, in academics, that's the only way you really achieve any payment for anything, any, you know, any remuneration for what you're doing. You know, why would you do that? You know, I'm just going to do trauma call or whatever. And that certainly would not be a way to slow down when you're 65 or 66 years old. You know, trauma call, as you remember from when you were a resident, Brittany, you know, at our place, it's, you know, I could go through two or three resident teams, you know, because of the 80-hour rule. If I were on call for a week, you know, I would be up, you know, two or three nights in a row, you know, potentially. And I think if I had known it was going to be that way, you know, I might have slowed down sooner and gone into practice. Right now, I'm not interested in going to a private practice. You know, not at 66 years.
We're hiring, though. No, just kidding.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and there would probably be those options, but that would have its own set of headaches. So, but you know, 5 or 7 or 10 years ago, I might have considered that. And it's not really a regret. I don't wish that I had done it, but you know, the abruptness of slowing down, you know, just basically stopping. And again, I'm sure there'll be people that'll listen to this and say, well, you know, I'm sure you could have stayed at Ohio State for a few more years, or you could have gone part-time, but no. I mean, no. I mean, can you imagine me? Can you imagine me as a part-time faculty coming in, you know, teaching dental students a couple days of the week at Ohio State? I mean, first of all, it wouldn't be fair to the new chair or anyone else, because, you know, they need to have a clean start. You know, they need to have the former chair gone, you know, not hanging out, you know, having staff come and second guess what's going on and things. You know, you need to be gone. And it's real difficult to then find a part-time gig if you only want to work a couple days a month, or, you know, a day a week or something like that.
Exactly.
I think that's probably the most challenging part of slowing down in an academic world, is it's just not designed for you to slow down.
Right. During your career, I mean, you have a wonderful family, wife and three boys, and who I got to know fairly well during residency also. And so I think it's important to, even though you had a busy academic career, you know, did you find that you were still able to kind of keep that balance, or, you know, kind of what was your schedule like as a surgeon? And then you know, family, friends, hobbies, you had a lot of all of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, my one son was born 6 weeks before I moved 1,000 miles from where our family was to Ohio. And, you know, we didn't have a babysitter. We didn't know anybody. And my other two kids were born here. And, I'm not criticizing my mentors at the time, but there was no paternity leave. There was no days off for delivery. I mean, I think I took 2 days off when my, you know, third son was born. And fortunately for the program, when my second one was born, it was a weekend, so I only had to be gone a day. And that was a difficult time for my wife, for sure. And it was difficult for me because, you know, I think it was, you know, I love my kids and I wanted to do stuff, right? And that was the way it was, you know, that was the way it was. And, you know, I said, sometimes you can learn things that you shouldn't do from your mentors as well. And I think, you know, one of the things I learned when I became the chair was, you know, you need to respect people's families and their personal time together. You need to know your staff. You need to know their families. You need to know your residents' kids. You need to, you know, have residents come to, you know, like you said, you know my kids. Well, there's not a compartmentalization there between this is all work and this is my family. And I think the way that that I addressed it is, my family is part of OSU's, you know, family. You know, we wouldn't, you know, if we were going to do something, you know, residents would come here, my wife would treats you guys like kids, like they're her kids. Or they were, you know, back in the day, like best friends or good friends because they were the same age. Actually, we were younger than all the residents and their wives when we started. If you can imagine that, being a faculty and being younger than everybody, literally everybody, because they were older and I was really young. But I think that ability to make what you're doing part of your family, so that instead of them looking at dad's gone at work because he likes work better than me, my kids would always say the residency and work is important to them too. They you know, I think when, you know, when I took care of patients, they thought they were part of that, you know. And, you know, if you're a surgeon, you're not going to, Brittany, you know, you have three small children. There are times when you aren't there because you have to go do something.
Right.
And, you know, somebody I really respect a lot, Sarah Ness, Greg Ness's wife, said, you know, one time we were kind of talking, she said, well, you know, I think it's just as important for your children when they're growing up to know that what their father or their mother does has value, is important. And that's almost as important as you being with them all the time. You don't have to be with them all the time for them to know that you care about them. But if they say, my mom, you know, this is your daughter, if my mom is an oral and maxillofacial surgeon, and there are people that really rely on her, she's really good at what she does. Mm-hmm. You know, that probably is as important as, you know, spending every second, you know, making it to every ball game or whatever. And, you know, we did some fun stuff. Academic practices probably allow some cool things. I mean, I've taken my kids to all these great venues, you know, like Boston and San Francisco and Seattle, and they've been to, you know, places and they've grown up being very comfortable around professional adults.
Yeah. And
I think that that is a gift you can give your kids because of your involvement with a lot of different professional people, and especially in an academic setting. I mean, they've grown up seeing residents, you know, that are doctors, young people. And I think that's, you know, that's helped. But, you know, I had a couple of very close friends just die over the past couple of years, you know, my age. You know, they were sort of our core group of six or seven parents of kids that we all did stuff with, and they just, you know, suddenly passed away, younger than I am. And it makes you stop and think, well, you know, there's a point in time where we all, you know, we're not all going to live forever. And there are some things that even if you're taking time to do things, you know, there's some things that require a critical mass of time, you know. I mean, I've done a lot of fun stuff, you know. I mean, I've traveled all over the world, probably you know, politically incorrect, but I've, you know, I probably shot creatures on every, you know, continent in the world. So I didn't wait to retire to do all those things, but I do think that there are some things that you can appreciate when you have a little bit more time. And so that does help. But I don't feel that my job competed with my ability to, you know, to have a great family.
Yeah.
Listen, there, no matter what job you have, and no matter where you live, and no matter who you work for, if you choose to have the things that intrude into your life become all that, you know, that consumes you, then every job will intrude on your family.
Yeah.
You know, that's just a life. It's, you know, you have to take some, responsibility yourself for realizing that no job is going to be perfect and no job is going to allow you to spend every second with your kids. I know that that's cited often as, you know, reason I couldn't go into academics, reason I didn't want this job, reason I didn't, But I think that there are lots of opportunities to do both. And I've always tried, and you know, as the chair, I really truly tried to have all of my faculty feel like their role as being good mothers, good fathers, you know, because I have both female and male faculty and residents, many, that, you know, it's not a competition between, you know, work and family. And you definitely would have more than a day or two off if you were a resident, male resident, and you happened to have a child while you were in my program.
Like 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, 3 or 4 hours, whatever. Yeah.
No, yeah, that's, I think that's very well said, because as chair, your family was very involved, but also you treated residents like family. And that's really important as a resident, because most people weren't where they're from, and they didn't have family around. So I always felt like you had adopted us as your kids, and, you know, as the daughter you never had. And so it's that was something that made, you know, that's led to the whole mentorship aspect, but just opening your home, becoming friends with your wife and kids, and integrating those things together is a really nice aspect of how you can have a busy career, but also, you know, do it all.
Yeah.
So I think as we sort of get toward the end, it would be nice if you could talk about any like interesting case that sticks out from your career. Like it could be good, it could be bad, just something that really sticks out. I have so many of those from residency. And then we'll kind of close with some of your hobbies, things you like to do, which are also pretty interesting. So start with a case, and then we'll go to the hobbies and kind of close it up.
Well, I just basically fell into doing the craniofacial stuff. And I looked around when I was there, and there was a young dental student that then stayed on the faculty as a prosthodontist. And she and I just hit it off over the years. And she had a real interest in ectodermal dysplasia, particularly. And one of the things that I would tell people, and I tell general dentists, is, you know, your opportunity to work with other people is one of those things that enriches your career. Lisa Noblo is Dr. Noblo is her name. We're very, very good friends. We're better friends than we were colleagues even. And, you know, treating those patients with ectodermal dysplasia from the time they were, you know, 3 or 4 years old. Some of them got implants, you know, in the mandible when they were 4 years old. We wrote papers on, you know, approaches to that. We did bone grafts and orthognathic surgery, and then, you know, full mouth reconstruction. So we treated those kids from, you know, the time they were 4 or 5 up until they were in their 20s. And when I retired, interestingly, I mean, I received so many letters and calls and different things from that group of patients. You know, they want to go to dental school. They send me pictures. They send me their senior pictures.
Oh, nice.
It's, you know, people that do orthognathic surgery and other things get the same kind of thing. But it was just a unique sort of niche for me, because not that many people have that opportunity. We were a center for ectodermal dysplasia. There's only a few in the country. And, you know, that was probably one of the highlights of my career. You know, in that same vein, though, I think if we don't see the problems that we have, the complications, we're destined to create more of them in the future. You know, one of my residents picked as her best case this patient that we had done orthognathic surgery on. He's a cleft patient, and he had an avascular necrosis, and he lost a significant part of his maxilla. And you know, that would not be one you would want to show at the dental meeting when you're trying to show people what a good surgeon you are, right? And it was devastating. I lost sleep for a year. But I think when the resident then picked that case after a year and a half of us managing this patient as, you know, her best case, I realized that it was the process of caring for the patient, you know, and, you know, this kid's mom sends text messages still to my resident that graduated a few years ago, you know, with photos of how things are going and what's going on. And I think that, you know, it taught me that something I knew, but I hadn't seen it in practice as much. And that is, you know, how you care for the patient, you know, the empathy that you have for them and the concern that you show them can be far more important than the perfect outcome, you know. Now, I got some bone grafts in this kid, and, you know, my friend Lisa did a full mouth rehab with, you know, zirconia, you know, framework and everything, and refused to take any money for it. And, you know, so, you know, he had a great result, all things considered, but, you know, it was because of all those relationships. I think that was probably why it means so much to me that, you know, the residents really came, they stepped up, you know, they answered calls in the middle of the night, and they did things to, you know, help this family, you know, work through this. The, you know, prosthodontist helped me. And I think that makes it one of my best cases. I hesitated. You know, they said they might ask me about cases. You know, no one wants to admit, you know, when you're doing cleft surgery, especially if you do a lot of orthognathic surgery, that you lose a maxilla. But that it happened, you know. Mm-hmm. And out of a career of, you know, 1,000 orthognathic cases, you know, or more, I'm sure, you know, to have that happen once is, I guess, not, you know, unheard of, but, you know, it's still something that probably sticks in my mind. If you're asking, you know, it's one of my best and worst times.
Yeah. I just remember that my last surgery day of residency, we did 2 or 3 cleft orthonathics, LaForce on 2 boys that had the same name. It was like Matt and Matt. I just remember, I'll always remember that day. I was like, go out with some easy cases, right? So, I mean, it's a huge service that you did, and there's not a lot of people that do it, and especially do it well. So,
well, thank you. And, you know, you couldn't do that outside of an academic setting.
Right.
Let's face it, you distraction and difficult cases, and, you know, something that I realized I couldn't do without residents. You know, we helping with workup and, you know, facilitating patients and things, as good as staff can be and other things, you know, that group of patients requires, you know, really, I think, the kind of special, you know, really comprehensive care that you get, you know, in a residency program. And, you know, and I think that was when I really started realizing how important the residents were, you know. For whatever reason, young patients like young doctors.
Yes. They're happy, is the head of it.
They're happy the old guy is there, you know, but they just as soon have you on rounds, Brittany, as me, okay?
That's a good team. So that's kind of your career, you know, in a nutshell. And outside of oral surgery, what kind of hobbies have you been, throughout? Towards the end of our residency, which I think became kind of a tradition, you took us to the range and we did a little bit of skeet shooting. So there's a lot of, you know, interesting things about you that some people might know. What kind of hobbies do you like to do?
Well, you know, I'm sure we didn't plan this, but it's going all the way back 360, because when I was 10, my dad would say, we're going to southeastern Kansas to such and such Iowa or wherever, Ottawa or whatever. And it was always the family of somebody who just died of leukemia. And they wanted Doc to come to the farm, come bird hunting, you know, let us do something for you. And so, you know, I had my shotgun when I was 10. I know that's the heresy in the world we live in now. I kept it behind the door in my room. And we would go bird hunting. And it was not about bird hunting. It was about, they wanted to respect my dad. They wanted to do something for him. He, you know, and they were happy to see, oh, this is your son, you know. And I drove me crazy. You know, when you're a kid, you don't want people, you know. But I learned that, you know, sort of like with golf, I mean, bird hunting has its own sort of etiquette. And it's a way that I, as a very young person, had a big responsibility, because, you know, those things are dangerous. And to be given that responsibility at a young age, you know, was cool. And I interacted with a lot of adults, and that was something that I learned. And so, you know, I grew up, that was my golf. That was my way of socially interacting with people. And of course I didn't do any of it during residency, and, you know, but as I got out, you know, Larry Peterson had grown up in Kansas, and he loved to bird hunt and to shoot shotguns. And so we went out and did that some. And somewhere along the line, and I don't really know, but probably somebody who grew up in Connecticut or New York or someplace who was taught that guns were terrible and you should never touch them, you know, asked me if I would teach them to shoot clay pigeons or something. And it sort of became a tradition. Even though I'd retired, the residents the other day called me and said, hey, you know, we know you can't teach us surgery anymore, but, you know, we need our annual clay pigeon shotgun shooting lesson. So I guess I still do that. And, you know, it's a social thing. It's about the people you interact with. And, you know, you meet people who you might not otherwise get to know. And I've developed some really great friendships, you know, even since you were, you know, a resident here, people that I go bird hunting stuff. But, you know, after a while, you know, you can also go sporting clay shooting or do things like that. And so it's something that I like. And I like to collect old shotguns. And some of that's just because I think it's kind of cool to have a 130-year-old shotgun. Think of it. I mean, that's, you know, somebody got that shotgun maybe when they were 20. So, you know, 130 years, that's a long time ago. And what did they do with it? And probably not that much different from what I do with it, you know. And there are very few things that endure that long, you know, material things that endure that long. And my wife is a very good sport. You know, I used the excuse that I needed to have a different shotgun for each boy. And then, of course, when I had young women that were in the program and, you know, people that wanted me, then I had to have some that they could shoot. So, you know, I've accumulated quite a number of shotguns over the years, you know, all with the excuse that they're for someone else. But so that's been, you know, a big part of what I do. And then, you know, goes along with that is, you know, fishing and, you know, being outdoors. I love to work in the yard and garden. And, you know, my wife and I, Patty and I, Patty's my wife, I keep calling her my wife, but Patty and I, we do those things together. And I think that's the other thing is that we really, truly enjoy doing stuff together and, you know, look for opportunity. So as I retire, you know, I'm busy every day. I don't have a schedule, but I'm busy, you know, doing stuff around the house and doing things that, so those are sort of my interests.
Nice. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I hope that anyone who listens learns a little bit about mentorship and sort of different career paths through the generations. I feel like now that we're colleagues and friends, but of course you're always going to be an important mentor, and you have been to so many. So thank you for having me here, and thanks for joining Dr. Larson. and have a great day.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brittany. I really appreciate you indulging me, you know, talking about stuff. And
my pleasure.
It makes me miss the time you were a resident.
Same. I think about residency all the time.
Yeah. Those are great memories.
They really are.
Give my best to your family, okay?
Oh, same. Same to you.
Bye-bye. Okay.
To learn more about OsteoScience Foundation, visit osteoscience.org or follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn.